Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Universal Narratives podcast. Today I'm actually very excited because we're going to be talking about an issue in education that I'm super passionate about, which is social justice education, equity, and racial equality. And it's my pleasure to actually interview a teacher who I think is probably more passionate about the topic than me. Welcome to our podcast, Soraya Zaidan.
Thank you, Salma. I really appreciate being here. It's an honor to talk with you this morning.
Thank you so much, Soraya. Would you like to start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, maybe where you went to school, what you do right now, and why are you so passionate about social justice in education?
Yes, of course. I'm Soraya Zaidan, and I have been a public school teacher in the New Jersey schools for almost 10 years now. I actually also went to college in New Jersey for both my undergrad and my graduate school. I went to Montclair State University. I throw on the shirt this morning, my college shirt, not realizing, but it coincides with the event. And I really am so passionate about social justice in the classroom because there's such a need for it. Yes. And it's unfortunate that we have this high need for it, but it's something that's definitely lacking in the public school system. Yes. And, you know, I try to, within my power and control, address this in my everyday teaching. But I do, however, recognize that the issue is beyond my students every year, and it's something that we need to address, you know, across the state and the country also.
Yeah, I mean, our classrooms right now are super diverse, and it's getting more diverse every single day. Mm-hmm. And that would take me to my next question, which is, would you like to like tell us a little bit more about the demographics of your class? Where do your students come from? And what is also the demographics of the staff and school personnel, teachers? Because, you know, there is always that mismatch. Mm-hmm. You know, what our students or where our students come from and who is teaching our students.
Yeah, absolutely. We do see a discrepancy. So 99% of my students are students of color. Of the 99%, 95% of them are Latino and Hispanic. Okay. As they identify. And then the other couple of percent, we have a small Black and South Asian population and a 1% white population also. So the majority are Latino students. And I would say the staff is 50% white, mm-hmm, and 50% are Brown and Black.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's very similar to New York City because, like, you know, the biggest demographic in our schools in New York City is, I would say, Hispanic or Latino students, mm-hmm, followed by African American, followed by, I would say, Asian, and then white, and then, mm-hmm, it would be like two or more races. And the teacher demographics is very similar to yours as well. So Soraya, what does it mean to you to be a teacher who stands for social justice and equity in the classroom?
It's a piece that I can't remove from my teaching. I know that there are teachers for maybe their personal beliefs or of their exhaustion, their emotional and mental exhaustion, that can, yeah, put that aside and go into the classroom and teach content and end their school day. And it's not a way that it's not something that I can remove from my identity as a teacher or from my beliefs and values in my teaching in the classroom. I think that students cannot learn from people who do not see them and who do not love them. It's not only about seeing, because representation is very on the surface. And I know oftentimes as people of color, we strive for representation because we just want to get something, right? Like, even if it's leftovers, we want it because something is better than nothing, yeah, in many cases. But representation is equivalent to me to the leftovers, right? Like, it's not meaningful. It's not meaningful enough. It's a bare start, but it certainly should not be the end point. And so in the classroom, I don't want students to only have representation in their curricula, but I want them to actually have authentic and meaningful and genuine lessons that they can connect to and grow from. I think that students should see themselves in the literature, regardless of the content area. And I think that that in itself also shows students that you see them and you acknowledge them in the classroom. And even before we get into content, something that I think is really important with teachers and their students, as far as seeing your students and loving your students and appreciating them, is first addressing their humanity. Mm-hmm. And one way to do that first is to consciously want to see them as people before we see them as students.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I've been doing with my students every day, and a lot of people will say, how do you do that every day? Why not just once a week? But yeah. Every day I ask them individually how they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And initially it starts out very, you know, for the first few weeks or a month or so, it's just very generic responses. But over time, students really, I think, start to feel like, I'm genuinely asking you, how are you? How are you today? And so this is where I learn, like, you know, I didn't sleep last night, or I work till the middle of the night, or one of my parents is in the hospital, or, you know, something is going on at home, or I'm having an issue with another teacher and I need an adult to talk to about it. You know, or today I might need to put my head down. I'm not sick, but I'm exhausted. Yeah. You know, and how would you know any of these things if you don't talk to your students as people first? They're not going to come and just share with you if that love and that comfort is not there to begin with.
Yeah, totally agree with that. Yeah, it's amazing. The power of conversation and dialogue is amazing. And sometimes we just feel like it's not as valuable because we're so swamped with the amount of work we have to do and the content that we have to cover. But sometimes these very subtle, I would say, conversations and, mm-hmm. you know, gentle remarks that we make in the classroom can make a huge difference in how our students develop a relationship of trust mm-hmm. with us and then open up eventually. And yeah. through opening up, we'll be able to learn more about who they are, where they come from, and then mm-hmm. adapt what we do, adjust what we do to meet their needs as students. So yeah mm-hmm. go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And, you know, back to you sharing the power of words and dialogue. It's yeah. so important. I have a piece also in the check-in time where students have the option to say, I passed today. So I don't want checking in to be something forceful. It should be something that, you know, you want to do if you want to. And, you know, when students pass it, or when they do comment and they say that they're not doing so well, I always say, you know, well, I pray that your day gets better and you deserve that thing that you want. And I hope that you feel happy and that you're able to shift what you can in your power. And if you need something, you know, please reach out to me. And just that alone, it's a few words on my end, right? Like that alone, I think, really makes students feel like, you know, I'm sitting in this classroom and I'm seen as a person and not just a student. I think it's so important because students should look forward to walking to their class or coming to their class. And I always tell them, I don't want you to dread this environment. Even if English is your least favorite subject, I want you to want to come here. Something else I think with the power of words that's really important is telling our students we love them. Mm-hmm. So once in a while, I'll say to my students, you know, I just want to remind you all that I love all of you. I love you. I pray the best for you. I want you to do well. And they're taken aback, you know, and yeah. I teach high school students. And
a lot I can of imagine.
Time, yes. A lot of times they say, people don't tell us they love us. Like yeah. teachers don't tell us, or let alone no one asks us in the school building, how are you today? So they're taken aback in a good way.
Yeah.
And it's sad that they're taken aback.
I know.
People should ask them, how are you? And check in with them. And I don't blame teachers. You know, I do just want to point that out. I know that teachers are inundated with work and pacing guides and curricula, and, you know, people have concerns about losing their career in our economy. And it's a very hostile work environment for teachers right now. Mm-hmm. But I do think that if we build that into every class, even if it's 5 minutes a day, that over weeks and months, it certainly makes a difference.
Totally agree with that. And I loved how you discussed the power of words, because I think words are just like, you know, they're very, it doesn't really take that much time, but it can make a huge difference. And
absolutely.
That's what really matters. Yeah. Do you feel like you brought up the idea of humanizing the experiences of your students? Do you feel like the experiences of your students are being humanized, valued, appreciated, and why or why not? And if this is happening, is it only happening in your classroom, or do you feel like there is a school-wide effort to humanize the experiences of all students, regardless of their background? Mm-hmm.
I do not think that public education across the country, let alone my district and my state, humanizes children and students. One of the reasons correlates to the curriculum. Mm-hmm. In over 90% of districts across the country, the majority of the curriculum is based on Eurocentric texts, whether it be in English or math or science or technology or any content area, the arts even. So I think that in itself shows us that we don't value our students for who they are, because we're not able to appreciate that their people have made contributions to our existence. I teach seniors, most of my students are seniors, and a lot of them will reach the 12th grade and say, I never read a Latino author.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I have a couple of years ago, I had a student from India who went to New Jersey public schools her entire life. Yeah. And she approached me at the end of the year because I want you to remind me later about something that I do to learn where my students are from, what countries they identify with and identities. But I knew she was from India. So I had brought in one time an excerpt, just a few pages from a novel I have by an Indian author, by Arundhati Roy. And she was very emotional and approached me at the end of the school year. And she said, you know, I'm 18 years old and I never even knew there were Indian writers who wrote in English. I didn't know. And this is why we don't humanize who they are, because we don't teach them who they are. We don't teach them that their people have made any contributions to our society. Yeah. And that's just one point, other than policing them and other than racist school policies. But if you just look at curricula, I think that in itself, you know, answers our question about who they are.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you mentioned the curriculum and incorporating experiences of people of color, because I feel like this is something really missing. And it's not only the books that we're reading, but also the classroom methods that we're using, the projects that we're planning. Sometimes it's just very, very, I would say, mainstream, and it does not really meet the needs of every single student in our class. And it's our role as teachers to try to accommodate as many students, or I would say all students, regardless of where they come from. Mm-hmm. You know, if you pick a learning strategy or a teaching strategy that works for some students, it might not work for others who come from a different country or a different immigration, I would say status, or I would say a language or a cultural background. You will have to really keep in mind all these different variants and try to accommodate your students as much as possible. On the school level, Soraya, do you feel like schools are trying to accommodate students of color and humanize their experiences now more than previously? And by that, I mean, over the past couple of years, there has been a lot of socio-political events taking place in the country. And there was that movement to try to accommodate and meet the needs and humanize the needs of all students. Do you feel like anything like that is happening in your school?
I want to say that whether it's my school or just, again, across public education, yeah, anytime I've seen it has been performative.
Okay.
It's not authentic action to actually change school policies and to change curricula. Yes, you know, February is approaching us and we know that it's Black History Month. So you'll see people put up posters or give an excerpt or throw in one thing or a couple of things by a Black writer, or to mention Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and to, you know, mention Black people one time in the school year, which I find to be a microaggression that you're only mentioning these people at this time once a year, whether it's Black History Month or Indigenous Peoples Month or Latinx History Month or whichever, you know, month it is. And a lot of times we see a trend where maybe for a day or a week, the theme in the classroom will be this. But then what about 90% of the school year, the focus is on white men and the contributions that they've made only. And we don't learn what inspired them or who they stole what from. We just learn that they made the contributions or the inventions or whatever it may be. So, you know, to go back to your question, I do not think that school districts anywhere, really, the majority of them at the very least, are making an authentic effort where we're examining school policies, where students are being given nutritious meals, where we're our students are learning about themselves in the curricula and being valued, you know, as well as, you know, not blaming students' mindsets on their situation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes instead of discussing racism and living wages, oftentimes actually, we blame the person's mindset or the way that they see something instead of addressing the truth. And a lot of times public education just feels like a system where we're avoiding the truth.
Yeah.
Because that's always the easiest thing to do, whether it's in our personal lives or a career. When we address the truth, the next step would be to address any consequences. And I don't think people are ready. It's not that we don't have the capacity or the capability. We just don't want to, as a collective, not as individuals. I know that there are individual teachers doing this work. But collectively, no, I don't see that schools are humanizing students.
So you mentioned symbolic representation, like including a picture or including a quote at a certain time of the year. But I believe what you're trying to say is that substantial changes are not really being made, because on the grand level or on the collective level, people are not ready to make these changes. So what's the role of teachers like yourself, who are very passionate about these issues? And I'm sure there are other people in your network, other educators who are also very passionate about issues of humanizing experiences of students, social justice, equity. What can teachers like yourself do to create equitable spaces for students, regardless of their background?
I think that organizing is the best method. A few years ago, I had brought something up as an individual in my school district to address the curricula. And although I had prepared my data and scheduled the meetings and made my points and was able to provide research to support my points that students were not being represented in their learning process, they are removed from the learning process, it was not successful. And I learned that I made a mistake. I messed up in that I went in as an individual and that I did not organize first with like-minded teachers and then address this at the district level. So I would say that organizing, you know, is the best method. Sometimes we don't find other teachers in our district and in our schools to organize with who are like-minded. And, you know, through my Instagram page, I've had the opportunity to connect with teachers across the state and the country. And that's something that seems to be very common. So I think even if it's through social media or even if it's through your state or your county or city, it doesn't necessarily have to be within the same school, but just to even like send out, you know, collective demands to the school district. But I think on an individual level to respond, there are some things that we can do. Because, you know, we're required to teach particular skills at certain times of the year as students progress in their learning process, but we can teach those skills with any text. It doesn't have to be the text that we're given.
Yes.
And in cases where we are mandated to teach a certain book and things like that, something that I personally do is I'll use less time on the pacing to teach that book so that I did my job on paper. I taught this thing and it's done and the kids learned it.
Yeah.
But I'll leave myself space to not to do books because I don't have the resources, but to do excerpts from books.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I do that I talk about in my multiculturalism in the classroom workshop is, you know, early on in the school year, I pass out a clipboard and I tell students not to write their name. You don't have to say, you know, you don't have to list yourself. And I tell them write down one thing at least that's part of your identity. It can be woman, LGBT, refugee, immigrant, Black, brown, indigenous, whatever the thing is that you identify with. You know, and sometimes students will list either a physical or a mental disability in that as their identity, or they'll list the country that they're from, that their family is from, their ethnicity. And so I make it my mission that school year to address as many of those things on the list as possible. Sometimes you can fulfill that by like doing an immigrant author story.
Yeah.
You know, it could be a fiction or a nonfiction. And I think we can do this across content areas and it'll fulfill a few of the identities on the list. And then I can start to kind of check off. And I learned that more times than not, students will approach me and say, I didn't even know undocumented people wrote books or articles or stories or immigrants, or because they don't have the exposure. And we might, well, isn't it obvious? Don't they know everyone has contributed? But how would our children know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's something that I do at an individual level in my classroom personally throughout the school year. I'll also make time for students to share on, you know, their responses and feelings to any of the events that happen around us concerning racial injustice and inequality. I think, and then going back to those check-ins that I shared with you, that's what creates the safe space so that students can say, you know, I would like to read this in class, or this week I feel this way because this is going on, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. You know, after the Trump election, I did that study where I interviewed teachers in New York City, and I asked them about how their teaching has been changed or impacted by the events, sociopolitical events. And it was amazing because most of the teachers were actually saying what you're saying right now, making sure that they're including, like focusing. The number one thing that many teachers spoke about was mental health, like trying to make sure that students are receiving the support that they needed, because students felt alienated. They felt like they were marginalized.
Absolutely.
Yes. So much hate that was happening. Hate speech directed towards certain groups. So the classroom had to be mainly a space for healing for many of the students. Yeah. Before even focusing on the academic side. And, you know, this would take me to our next question, which is, you being a person of color, female with a headscarf, and I'm sure sometimes when you try to speak up, you are not always appreciated and you might find some pushback. How do you deal with that as a teacher, as an educator? Yeah,
for sure. I think when we teach in this country and when you're not a white person and a white woman teacher, you know, being someone who's outspoken and has empathy and cares about social justice and racial equality, you know, it's what you said it is. It's not something that's appreciated. I think that people would always rather that we don't complain, like, you know, you have a job and you should just do your job and leave like everyone else. And like, why are you causing disruption or pointing things out if things seem to be going along? You know, I think that I want to say that there is some pushback, you know, as far as, you know, making changes, like serious changes to the curricula. And I'm not just talking about someone sitting down and having a meeting to hear my thoughts, but I think that, you know, there is pushback to change. And I wish it was only an issue that had to do with my district or my state, because then you would say, well, this is just the problem of this one place. But I think it's, you know, it's definitely an issue that we have across. And I also have noticed that with teachers that I know who are Black women, they are facing, you know, the most pushback in their teaching and what they're discussing in the classroom, if they're doing anything beyond what's in the pacing. And I think that, you know, first, being Palestinian, I have learned that you're going to face pushback when you speak up and you say things that are true. And so it almost has given me a kind of resiliency and strength to be okay with having people Disagree. This, you know, speaking up is not for people who are going to back away. It just doesn't work that way. Yes. It really does not. So I have found that, you know, if people want to be critical, and you know, as a woman, when people say you have a strong personality, it's not a compliment.
I know. Right?
It's not a compliment across most cultures.
Yes.
When a woman, you hear, oh, well, this woman, she has a very strong personality, or she's too outspoken. But I have learned to, you know, to embrace this as my personality. And it's not a personality flaw to speak up. And I want to be that person who cares a lot and who has empathy. And, you know, earlier you said something that really resonated. You said that the social and emotional well-being of our students is more important than the academics. Mm-hmm. And it absolutely is. So I would rather always address that first and see that as the priority over the academic piece, because how can you learn from someone who doesn't see you or appreciate you or love you? And, you know, just as far as being a woman of color who's visibly Muslim in the public school system, you know, and I'm sure that it's been about 10 years. I have, inshallah, many more years of teaching to go. There will always be some resistance and pushback. And it's something that I have grown almost accustomed to. But it's something that I want to keep fighting, you know, for the long run. I don't see myself caring less or backing away from this cause.
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. Soraya, now I know your network or your professional and social circles include people from other backgrounds as well. Yeah. And including educators, teachers, professors, everybody who's involved in education. Mm-hmm. How do you work together to inform policy, I would say, and educate, I would say, your professional and social circles about the need for social justice and education?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do have many friends that are teachers and professors in my network, and just people who are social media friends. Yeah. And I think that can be very powerful. Me and you met through social media, right? So I think that it could be very powerful and, you know, something that leads to genuine relationships amongst people. Mm-hmm. I also work as an adjunct professor, and so that has also given me opportunity to meet, you know, more professors and chairs and deans at the higher ed level. Something that I've been doing is having workshops on, you know, on topics that I can teach on, and attending other teachers' workshops. So I think that finding people who are like-minded and supporting each other's learning and each other's talks and presentations is one way. You know, I'm also finding that forming committees, mm-hmm. Having book clubs that are meaningful,
yeah,
and, you know, discussing policy, it makes us feel less alone. A little over a year ago, I came across other Arab teachers in the country through online. And it started out with, you know, one teacher reached out to me from Texas, and she connected me with a couple teachers in California. And we like found a few other teachers. We, you know, there are not many, I want to say, Arab teachers in the public school system. Mm-hmm. And so we formed we kind of organized a group amongst ourselves where we meet monthly, and we called it the Arab Educator Network.
But oh my God, that's great. You know, I was just thinking about this the other day, because I was thinking I came across something, Arab American mm-hmm. something. I was like, do we even have like an Arab American Educator Network? So I'm very glad you brought this up. That's great.
Yes, it's definitely something that I can share with you more on later
too, sure.
If you're interested, but just finding people so that we feel less alone. Yes. And I don't have that in my state, but I know that I can get on that Zoom and have that like love and support that we have for each other mentally and emotionally. And we can, and you know what, regardless of what each one of us experiences, the issues are so similar, mm-hmm. even though we're like on different sides of the country, because these are, you know, public education, systemic issues so much more often than they are just a district issue.
Yes.
Yeah,
definitely. So Soraya, how do you develop yourself professionally? You're always, I know you're involved in presenting and giving a lot of workshops about all these issues that you're very passionate about, but how do you keep on track in terms of educating yourself about what's happening and, you know, just being informed?
Yeah, it's not an easy thing.
It's very time and I would say time consuming and giving your schedule.
Yeah, it's a lot. I want to say especially it's been something that I've been feeling more so in the last few years since becoming a single parent 4 years ago. It could be overwhelming, but I think that something that I try to work on is what my priorities are and time management, because other than learning about things that I care about and then presenting on them to share that with other educators, because ultimately my goal is that we're improving the learning spaces for students. So the one way that I can do that is by helping other teachers to, by maybe teaching teachers and talking with teachers to do that. And something that I do to keep informed is also learning from other educators.
Yeah.
So if, for instance, I were to see that you were presenting on something, I might say, okay, you know, Selma's talking on this particular topic. I need to learn more on it, and just kind of addressing where we need to each grow.
Yes.
And just, you know, making it a priority to say, you know, this week, I'm going to use an hour a week to learn on this related to education, whether it be by supporting another teacher or by just finding content. I also reach out to other educators to find out, you know, what books they might suggest to read. Yeah. Like, what are they reading? What are they learning? You know, educators that I respect, and just, you know, having some, you know, talks with each other and being open enough to learn and to admit where we're wrong and to recognize where, you know what, I did this for a few years, but it's actually, it wasn't the best thing. And just, you know, being open enough to learn and to implement what we're learning also, not just learn for the sake of learning.
I love that. You know, I work with teachers most of the time, and the first thing I tell them is self-reflection is the most important tool to become a better teacher, not only in terms of what you do in the class, but also in terms of recognizing your biases, which most of the time are very implicit, and you don't even notice it until you like really pay attention to what's happening in the class. And reading, as you said, reflection circles are amazing. Just talking to other people, reading, and as you said, implementing, because sometimes we know the information, but we're not comfortable enough to make the changes. And, you know, just stepping out of our comfort zones and trying to implement some of these changes in our classrooms, even if it's something very minor, like incorporating a social emotional component in our lessons. But maybe starting with something small is better than nothing. And then you can expand on that in the future.
Yeah.
Soraya, my last question to you would be, how would an ideal school look like in your opinion? Or I would say a classroom.
An ideal classroom. Okay. It makes a smaller scale.
Yeah.
I think in an ideal learning environment, students would be greeted by teachers and staff, and they would not be greeted by police officers and security. Mm-hmm. So that this way, upon entering school, and this especially happens in schools where predominantly we have brown and black and marginalized children for all ages. So they would start the day by being greeted not with law enforcement, but with educators and people that work in the building. I would say that it would look like, you know, students having nutritious meals also upon entering their learning environment. And in the classroom,
I love that. I think a lot of people do not talk about what our students eat in the school. And it's really, really very, very important. And what kids eat in general in the country. Unfortunately, there is so much GMO and sugar and so much that we don't talk about. And I think, you know, nutrition is overlooked. We really have to talk about this more.
Yeah, for sure. So there would be meals that are nutritious. It would include breakfast. It would include lunch. We want our kids to be focused the entire school day. But if you're not fed and your meals don't have nutrition in them, how are we aiding in that focus? Also, I would say giving students the opportunity to have a say in things that, in the way that the classroom is set up.
Yeah.
And that could be something like, you know, giving them like a wall or a space where maybe they're putting in, they're posting their pictures or their families or things they love or things they identify with, just giving them a space of home or comfort or safety. Mm-hmm. And I think even just incorporating, whether it's a science or math or English classroom, displaying books that are reflective of their people's contributions.
Yeah.
So if I know my students and I know that, you know, what parts of the world they come from, you know, books are very easily accessible. So in this classroom environment, we would have resources where, regardless of the content area, I can display, you know, scientists and mathematicians and writers and whoever else are on the classroom, and giving students access to, you know, during the lesson, I need a break. So I'm going to get up and walk around the room and I'm going to skim through this book, and just some freedom. I think that we need to steer away from this idea that the classroom is run like a prison, where you're coming in and you're sitting down for 45 minutes or in some cases much longer.
Yeah.
Not moving, not talking, and just absorbing information the entire time. It's not realistic, and I don't think that it's something that works successfully at all. An ideal classroom for me would also not include any standardized testing.
It would just, I like that you brought that
up. Yes, and we know that in urban school districts, our kids are given those so much more throughout the school year than in other places. I think that there's a way that we can find maybe a diagnostic test early in the school year in every content area to see where our kids need to improve, mm-hmm. and then testing them again at a later time. And that should be enough.
Yeah.
And I think that kids should be involved in that process where, you know, we're giving them reports of where they're falling and asking them where they want to improve and just including them in their own goal setting, because we don't include them at all in the process.
You know, I'm nodding throughout this because that's how we learn how to be teachers, right? This is what they teach you in graduate school, like, yeah. You know, accommodating students' needs, making sure you appeal to their interests, listen to them, give them choice. Why are we not doing this? And this is what I teach the teachers that I work with, but it's just, the reality is very different than you know. And, you know, I feel like there is always this gap in communication between graduate school or like teacher preparation programs and teachers. Why are we not working together as a community of educators to try to push for changes in our schools? I mean, I feel like researchers and college professors, they're just publishing, including myself, we publish papers, we go to all these conferences and stuff like that. But then are we really, sometimes we are working in the classroom to actually inform decision making and make changes?
Yeah, I think we need to, as a collective, get better at organizing. I don't see any other way other than organizing and demanding that we start having these changes and that these students' needs are met. And I don't think it's something that can happen through reform. I really think, and I recognize as I'm about to share this with you, that this is not popular, but I really think the only way is to go away with the entire system and to build a new one, because reform, as we've seen over the years and the decades, is not successful and it's not authentic. So I think that the only way to create safe spaces where students are, you know, learning and being reflected and appreciated in their learning process and actually gaining social and emotional knowledge, as well as mental health support, and advancing in their academics, it's not gonna happen the way that we're running things right now. And a couple of more things I would add, by the way, to the ideal classroom is that there would be mental health support available.
Yes.
And you know, we're seeing in many public schools, especially those that are in urban school districts, where you're more likely to find a police officer or a security guard in the school building, they normally outnumber the number of counselors that are available. Yeah. And even schools that have counselors, usually those counselors are there for scheduling purposes. They're usually not there for mental health support. And that's not a criticism of them. That's a criticism of the system. And that's what they're being placed there for.
Yeah.
So definitely there would be mental health support for students. We would also teach students what their rights are. We don't talk to students about that. And I started to notice that my undocumented students, many of them didn't even know that they could go to college in New Jersey. So I think that we need to look at our student population and we need to tell our students what their rights are. You know, most students don't know that whether or not they want to stand up and pledge to the flag every morning is not something that's mandated. And so I think that we need to talk to students about what their rights are, because I think that them not knowing only benefits people who are oppressive.
You know, the problem I feel like with all the standardized testing and the demands that we have of students in the classroom, we also do not give as much attention to like civic education or like mm-hmm. civic and democratic education in general. Yeah. And so students are not aware of the rights inside their schools, first mm-hmm. and foremost, and they're not aware of the rights outside school as members of the community, as people mm-hmm. who live in this country, mm-hmm. certain things that they have to do, they can do actually, regardless of their immigration status mm-hmm. or their legal status. Yeah. So, yeah. And I believe, like, you know, it's just because we are so focused on standardized testing, we're so focused on content, and education is supposed to be like a holistic process, not only focusing on certain mm-hmm. areas and overlooking other parts of the child. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that a lot of times, and I've seen this in so many different schools where a couple of times a year, they might bring in a speaker, like a motivational speaker. And I know that they're well-intentioned, but a lot of times we put the blame on student failure on their mindset.
Yeah.
And that blames the individual. And that's not productive because it's also not true. We don't say, well, the reason that you're struggling more while learning as a student of color, as a Black student or a marginalized student has to do with racism and living wages. And because we're not giving you all of these resources, you know, and I think that to make students believe, oh, all I have to do is shift the way that I think and I'm going to be successful in this country that's built on the foundations that it's built on. It's not true. And so I think that if we, you know, use restorative justice practices in the classroom and have mental health support and nutritious meals and a curriculum that's actually reflective of who our students are, I think that all of these would build, along with other factors, to a classroom that's ideal. And the thing that's actually most, I want to say, disappointing about that is that I don't think I listed anything that's outrageous. We have the means to do all of this. And it's just a matter of students are not the main component or the main or even crucial to this, you know, because we treat students, you know, we use this business model in public education and we treat students like consumers and not like humans. And I think that there we definitely need to start to organize more collectively instead of so many of us individually, and to start to push through these changes. I think we covered a lot of things.
It was great.
And it was wonderful to talk to you. And I'm definitely open to talking with you again if there's ever an opportunity.
I would love to continue the conversation. That was real, really great. And I think it's an eye-opening conversation for a lot of educators nationwide as well. I'm hoping people would find it as insightful and as eye-opening as I did. Thank you so much, Suraya. And I look forward to talking to you again soon in the future.